My name is Ethan Gregory Dodge. I am a co-founder of the Truth and Transparency Foundation, and we are sponsoring this debate. It is not called the Gender Revolution, but that is what Blair is going to be presenting on because she's going to be first. It's called A Profit for a Day. And essentially, these three wonderful people here are going to be telling you that if they could be profit for a day of the LDS Church, what policies or doctrines or whatever it may be, they would change about the LDS Church, right? Me as the moderator, I'm going to be pushing back a little bit on things that maybe how it might affect attendance or how it could be viewed among the really orthodox or different other groups within the church. So I'm going to introduce all of our panelists really quick, and then we're going to go in alphabetical order. Blair's going to go first, and then Mark, and then Ben, and they're going to get 10 to 15 minutes each to lay out their three points of what they would change. And then once all three of them are done, I am then going to take about 5 to 10 minutes for each of them and push back, and then whatever time we have left, which should be fairly significant, is going to be open to Q&A for y'all. If you don't have enough a bunch of questions, that's fine. We could leave early, you know, get a half hour back of our lives. So this is meant to be very fun, very playful. We're just kind of laid back here. We're all very tired after a long, long conference. So with that, let me introduce the speakers here, the panelists. Blair Osler is a philosopher specialized in queer studies and is a leading voice at the intersection of queer, Mormon, and transhumanist thought. She's an author publishing her first book, Queer Mormon Theology, An Introduction. She is a board member and former CEO of the Mormon Transhumanist Association, the world's largest advocacy network for the ethical use of technology and religion to expand human abilities. She is also a board member at the Christian Transhumanist Association and Sunstone. Blair is also an artist and poet and spends her spare time hiking, painting, writing, bickering with her friends about almost any topic imaginable. Blair and her husband Drew reside in Utah with their three children. Mark Pugsley is a partner at the law firm of Ray, Quinney, and Nebaker in Salt Lake City and chair of the firm's securities litigation group. He has been working to recover money for victims of investment fraud and Ponzi schemes throughout the United States for over 25 years. Mark has recovered tens of millions of dollars for his clients and has been recognized as a leading expert in securities litigation by numerous rating agencies, including Best Lawyers, Utah Business, Super Lawyers, Martindale, Hubbell, and Benchmark. Mark writes and edits a blog called UtahSecuritiesFraud.com, which tracks financial fraud cases perpetrated by and against members of the LDS Church, among other things. He has been interviewed on fraud issues by the Wall Street Journal, the Salt Lake Tribune, the Deseret News, KSL, Mormon Stories Podcast, the Thoughtful Faith Podcast, Sunstone Podcast, and on numerous local news programs. Mark received his law degree from Duke University School of Law in 1994, and a master's degree in public policy from the Stanford Institute of Public Policy at Duke University. He received his bachelor's degree in political science from the University of Utah in 1991. Awesome. And without further ado, I'm going to turn the time over to our panelists.
Benjamin.
Oh, my God. They didn't put you in
Ben's here.
Ben's here,
too, by the way.
You're not on the panel anymore. I forgot to tell you. You're not in here. Your bio's not in here, Ben. Yeah, hold on. Let me see if I can pull it up in the app really quick. That was very rude of them. Not my fault.
I could just say it in 30 seconds.
Yeah, go for it.
My name is Benjamin Schaefer. I'm an attorney. I have a small law firm in Spanish Fork, Utah. I was formerly a member of the mainstream LDS Church. In the LDS Church, I have served as a CES teacher. I've taught seminary in Utah and in Arizona. I was also a temple worker and things like that. However, in 2011, I converted to Christ Church, which is a small LDS movement church, trying to live the fullness of the gospel. So, yes, is the answer to the question of do you believe in, because we kind of believe in the whole big wild mess that is Mormonism, though we may interpret a few of those things slightly differently. And I'm just glad to be here. So let's do this.
Awesome. Blair, come on up.
All right.
Let's give a round of applause for Blair.
All right, so I was told I'm allowed to change three things if I'm profit for a day. So I'm going to focus my three things into one big thing, which is the gender revolution. which sounds crazy and wild, but basically it's really meta. It's just making the church available so that someday I could be a prophet, maybe, because I can't. So just to clarify also, some of this is a little more radical and extreme. So this is a long-term program. So though it's a three-step plan, it's meant to be happening over long, long time to get people acclimated to the idea of singing women in authority and positions of leadership and integrating queer folks and all sorts of things into church policy. So, without further ado, the gender revolution includes the queering of Mormonism. Preliminaries. So, we're under the assumption that we want the church to thrive. So we want this to be a good thing that's actually going to help the church. We have to account for the church's global diversity. This is more than Utah's church. It's more than the U.S. church. It's a whole global church. And part of my proposal as me being prophet is the essential need to get collective feedback regularly, because when you're having a revolution, I have no interest in being someone's dictator. I actually don't even want to be prophet, but, you know, they asked me to be on the panel. So I broke it down into three steps, and then we're going to have some sub-steps that go under these things. So the first step would be the ordination of women. The next step is what I call gender integration, and we'll talk some more about that. And then the last one is called queering polygamy. So I know you just can't wait to hear what that is. Your imagination is running wild. Unless you read my dialogue article, then you know what queer polygamy is. Okay, so for the ordination of women, to prepare people to be ready to receive said revelation, we need to start changing our language concerning the priesthood. And actually, this process has kind of already started, to stop referring to the priesthood as inherently a masculine thing, referring to the men as the priesthood or anything like that, and the priesthood being the power and authority to act in God's name. And anyone could have the capacity and potential to do that. So we would integrate women into more activities which don't necessarily require ordination. If you read Nylan McBain's book, Women at Church, basically everything she has said in that book are things we could be including women in right now without even ordaining them. So we include more talks and firesides and education about priesthood responsibilities to prepare people for the revelation of the ordination of women. And under this step, we have to stop all anti-queer speech. You can't say bad things about queer folks anymore. It's just not going to be tolerated under the new prophet. All right. So once women are ordained, this has all sorts of implications, right? Women can now give blessing to their children and baptize people, and opens up the possibility of having all sorts of different kinds of callings that are required, you know, to be done by an ordained priesthood holder. And this is going to require some gender integration. So right now the church functions in a very set binary of women do this and men do this, and it's definitely very gender segregated. So once everyone has the opportunity to, I shouldn't say everyone because this doesn't necessarily include trans folks yet, but once cis men and women are able to be ordained to the priesthood, they can hold all sorts of different kinds of offices. So we need to have, again, more talks, more firesides, more education about how we go about doing this. We need more pilot programs. The idea of having a Relief Society president in the bishopric is one way to get people comfortable with the idea of men and women working together. Again, constant feedback on small and big changes. We adjust accordingly because this is not going to be an easy change. It's going to be a little bit turbulent. But, you know, we've done crazy things like ordain, you know, other people that were never ordained, and we figured it out and kept moving along the way. We account for various cultures outside the U.S. So here's the tricky part. So if we ordain women and take away some of the essentialist views of gender roles, we have to take into account that the church is a global church, and so it'd be really easy to say, well, you should just kind of succumb to American-centric values and ideas about, oh, women should be able to do this. There's been some research and studies done by people in Mormon academia that show that the proclamation to the family has actually been really beneficial for some women in developing countries who have been assigned the responsibility of both providing for their families and childcare for their families, and have been doing both roles essentially. And the document of the family proclamation has actually been empowering for them to say to their husbands, look, you have to carry your weight too. You have to do some of the work too. And so if I come in and say, you know, gender integration, let's throw gender roles out, that'd be almost like a sense of white imperialism of me coming into other cultures and saying you need to adopt my value set now. So again, this is going to be a really slow change. At the same time, just because the family proclamation is working maybe for this area of the world, for this subset of women, it may not be working for this subset of women. So we have to take those into account and really try to teach people to fulfill roles not necessarily based upon their gender, but just based upon the idea of being a good, decent human being and pulling your weight. I like the Joseph Smith idea. We teach them correct principles and let them govern themselves. So this is what gender integration is. And gender integration is also getting towards the idea of queer inclusivity. So this is where we start introducing the idea of, well, if anyone can be ordained, and anyone can hold any office or calling or things like that, why are we continuing to exclude trans, queer, non-binary folks? If it's not completely gender segregated and predicated on these gender roles all the time, can't we include queer genders too? And the answer is yes, we can. And that's where this comes in, during the gender integration phase. We integrate queer people into priesthood ordination and things like that, and being able to be, I should say, full robust fellowship in the church. That's a polite way of putting it. Okay, so we want to get to queer polygamy. So what the heck is that, bananas? So I wrote a paper for Dialogue, if anybody had read it. It's called Queer Polygamy, and I spell the whole thing out in there. The long story short is the idea of bringing back ideas of polygamy, and when I say polygamy, that is an entirely loaded word, and I'm saying it more as a philosopher than I am as someone who's ever practiced or anything. We bring back the idea of polygamy being that plural ceilings are available to anyone who wants them. So as of now, men can be sealed to multiple women, dead or alive. Women cannot. Women have to wait till they die or someone else dies, or someone's got to be dead for women to be able to be sealed to multiple people if they want to be sealed to multiple people. This is also a problem with children. So hypothetically, if we have someone in a mixed orientation marriage, dad's gay, mom's straight. They decide they get a divorce. It's not working out. Dad goes and marries new dad. Mom goes out and marries new dad. Well, the children can choose to be sealed to all their parents if they want to be sealed to all their parents. So children are not designated as a hierarchy of patriarchal property where men are collecting wives and children to adorn their mansions above. It's a product of consensual plural sealings for anybody who wants them. The long story short of queer polygamy, you should probably go read the paper because it's way better than everything I'm telling you right now. But the essential part of it, you should be able to be sealed to who you want to be sealed to, and you should be able to not be sealed to who you don't want to be sealed to. And I call it queer polygamy because I just have to shock people into looking at it in a totally new and different way, and I borrow queer language, academia, to promote the idea. So anyway, once we get to this point, trans people can be ordained, you can marry who you want to marry, and families really are meant to be together eternally, and it means children can choose the parents they want to be with and be sealed to, as opposed to, I am owned by my biological father, and it means that women can practice polyandry if they want to, and basically it's just creating a more queer, inclusive environment where any gender and any person can participate in the ways that they really want to. Again, this will take a long time to get there, but that's the gist of the gender revolution.
Well, I'll try to do it from here. Can everyone hear me all right? I'm happy to be here, and I was thinking about this, one of the things that was interesting to me about the panel idea is that there's some of us, including myself, who find themselves criticizing church leadership from time to time, sometimes a lot. There's lots of things that all of us would like to see changed about the LDS Church. I think most people would probably admit that. But it's actually not that easy. And the concept of putting yourselves in the shoes of church leaders, to me, is an interesting challenge. Because the problem the church has, and I think you are all aware of this, is that if the church starts moving one direction or the other, it's like a tube of toothpaste. If you move too far to the left, then to the right, you lose people to the Denver Snuffer folks and whoever else is out there on the right side. If the church moves itself too far to the right, then they start losing people who leave the church or just otherwise distance themselves because they don't like the perception that the church is moving towards a Republican agenda or whatever else people want to describe. So the church leaders actually are in a very difficult situation trying to keep all the toothpaste in the tube. And I think for me, it's an interesting exercise to think about this. Now, I want to say that Blair's ideas are much more academic than mine are, and mine are very practical. And part of that is because my background is in financial fraud. I specialize in helping victims of Ponzi schemes and whistleblowers and other sorts of people who have knowledge of fraud. And so what I deal with is financial problems. That's all I do. And as a result, I get calls and I have contacts within the financial industry and also victims of fraud, and I hear a lot of things. And one of the things that is I want to talk about first, which is based on my background, is major financial reforms. To me, one of the things that's the most frustrating about the LDS Church, the Mormon Church, or whatever you want to call it, is the lack of financial transparency. I advise people who are investing, and I ask them this question: if you would you give your money to an organization if they refused to tell you what they were going to do with it? And most people answer, "Of course not. I would never do that." And then I say, "Well, you do it every day, every Sunday when you contribute your tithing. You're actually contributing to an organization that is not telling you what it is that they're doing with your money." So, because of some of the contacts I have, and I obviously am not going to talk about who they are, I am aware, I have good information. We're here with Truth and Transparency. So the Truth and Transparency that I'm going to share with all of you today, and I've shared it before, is that the church has assets in the stock market, foreign and domestic, stocks and bonds, worth in excess of $100 billion. That is not including real estate. That's liquid assets that the church maintains. Where does that come from? Well, it comes from interest off of the tithing that they take and they repurpose it and invest it. Why in the hell does the church need $100 billion in the stock market? Why do they need that much money? What is the rainy day that they're waiting for? And so my idea, if I was in charge, and to put that in perspective, by the way, if you look at the amount of cash that the biggest corporations in America have also invest in the stock market, Apple has about $244 billion, so more than the church. Number two is Microsoft, who has a current cash stockpile of about $138 billion. The LDS Church would be number three. So what is it doing with this money? Why do they need it? If I were the first thing I would do if I were a prophet for a day is I would open up the books. I think members who contribute to the LDS Church need to know where their money is going. Where is it used? Who's getting paid? How much are they getting paid? Why do they have so much in reserve? And what is the point of that? How much is it going to cost to renovate the Salt Lake Temple? Does anyone know? Of course you don't know.
I know, but I can't tell
you. I can't. I know. The estimate I've seen is about $200 million. That's just the Salt Lake Temple renovation. The renovations that are going on and the building of temples throughout the United States, they're extremely expensive buildings, and that's just one example. Why don't people know that? Why shouldn't they know that? It's their money. Why can't they know what the church is spending on these things? It's baffling to me why more people aren't knocking down the gates of Temple Square demanding to know how their money is being used. It's your money. I assume one of the reasons people don't know is that the church thinks that donations would dry up, and they may be right. But if I were able to have access to the $100 billion, I would immediately open up the books. But the second thing I would do is I would embark in a worldwide campaign of charitable giving and charitable foundations unlike anything the world has ever seen. To put this in context, one of the most respected charities in the world is the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Anyone know what their assets are? How much is their foundation? Last report was it's $58 billion. So the church would double that, more than double that potentially. Think of the good. Think of the good that could be done with $100, $120 billion in this world. How many people could be housed? How many people could be provided with clean water? How much good could be done in terms of combating global warming or curing disease like malaria? I mean, honestly, what would Jesus do with $100 billion? I mean, isn't that the test we should apply to any church that claims to be the only true church on the face of the earth? If they're saving it for a rainy day, I would say that it's raining now. Now's the time. People are dying. Global warming is happening. Let's do something about this. And that brings me to my number two idea, which is let's put the missionaries to work. Many of you know in Utah, it's kind of a fad these days to go on a service trips. Service trips are a big thing amongst high school kids. They're going to India, they're going to South America, and they're doing, they're building schools and doing all sorts of cool stuff. What does that say? It says that our youth here in Utah and throughout the Intermountain West and in the church and out of the church, these kids want to do stuff that's real. They want to get their hands dirty. They want to make a difference in the world. So we have all these kids with this energy to get out there and make a difference. And what are we doing with them? Well, the minute they graduate high school, we're sending them out to knock on doors and bug the shit out of people. Why are we doing that? Why do we tell people that
it
they
builds character.
It builds character. No, it doesn't. It's terrible. And I think if you have this army, it's literally an army. It's referred to in the scriptures as an army, and it is. It's whatever it is, 50,000 kids. Think of the good that those kids, instead of putting them in their suits and ties, let's give them some jeans and some work gloves, and let's send them out to make a real difference in the world. A real difference in the world. Let's stop making them dress up like FBI agents, and let's give them something to do, something productive. If you ask any return missionary, and you have them with honest answers, they're going to tell you about the incredible monotony and drudgery of missionary work. People who haven't been on a mission don't realize that it's 98% drudgery and 2% a pretty good experience now and then. So let's give them something to do. Let's have them build a school. Forget the door-to-door contacting. Nobody likes that. Facebook is not going to solve this problem. The fact is, there are people out there who are hungry. There are people who need clean water, shelter, schools, and toilets. There's much work to be done, and we have a bunch of kids that would love to do it. And you talk about building character, think about that. Think about the kind of character that would be built by having these kids engage in 2 years of service. And guess what? We can fund it with the $100 billion. they'd still learn a language. It would still also learn a lot about love. In fact, I would say that they would learn a lot more about love by actually getting their hands dirty and serving people than they would about knocking on doors. Many of you may have seen the Book of Mormon musical. It's opening again in Salt Lake. If you haven't seen it, I highly recommend it. If you have to put up with some swear words, but it's actually fantastic. And the central conceit of the Book of Mormon musical is that they send a bunch of, how absurd it is to send missionaries to Africa in their white shirts saying that we have this book and this book will save your life and will change your life. And people are like, well, We have AIDS, you know, and does the book solve AIDS? And of course it doesn't. And that's the whole absurdity of the missionary program. They caught it all in a play. It's a great play. You really should see it. And that's kind of what I'm getting at here, is there are needs in the world. If you've been to Africa, there's so much to be done. If you've been to South America, there's so much to be done. I actually served my mission in Fiji, the Fiji Islands in the South Pacific. It was an awesome mission. I was very lucky. I served for 6 months as a branch president in a little town, and in that town was also a couple of Peace Corps volunteers. And I can tell you one thing, is that when the villagers saw us coming down the street, they would kind of duck into the door and try to avoid us. But the Peace Corps volunteers who were there giving people clean water were beloved. Those folks, everywhere they went, everybody loved them, because what were they doing? They were actually giving somebody, these people, something they needed, sanitary situations, or helping them get rid of their waste, and they were also helping them have clean water, digging wells. I mean, honestly, if you want to help people, let's help them. Giving them a book is not going to change their lives. I'm sorry, it just doesn't. Number three, my last one has to do, again, I'm very practical, so I'm going to talk about practical things. The last one is about the chapels. We have these chapels all over the world. If you calculated the real estate alone that our chapels reside on, it's worth tens, maybe billions of dollars, I don't know. When I was in Fiji, the chapels were, frankly, the best buildings in the area. When you'd see a chapel, this is true in a lot of third world countries, the LDS chapels kind of stand out because they've got the steeple, but they're nicely built, they're very strong. Well, in Fiji, we had hurricanes that would come through once a year, sometimes twice a year, and one of the problems is that the chapels were off limits to people. They were not permitted to be used for shelter, even though in many villages the chapel was the strongest building around. And if you watch other natural disasters, you'll see fires and other things that the church, actually I assume, I don't know, but I think the church actually has a policy against, for the most part, against permitting chapels to be used for shelter and emergency. What the hell is that about? Honestly, why? Why do you have these chapels throughout the whole world that are the nicest, strongest buildings you can imagine, and then when something really bad happens, they're not used for practical things? So my number three is I would turn chapels into a place of refuge. And I would say that the kitchens that you're not allowed to cook in, we should be cooking in those, and we should be cooking for the homeless. Let's have the homeless come to our chapels as a place to get food. Why wouldn't we use these beautiful facilities? And maybe even they could sleep there. I mean, you know, they might have to leave on Sundays, but why not? What would Christ do with all the temples that we have in this country, in this world? The other thing is I would fill them with cots, food, medical, and emergency supplies, and outfit them with emergency generators. Other churches, this is very common, other churches house food pantries, preschools. They have AA meetings at churches. They have after-school programs and many other programs. Churches, if you go to a Catholic church or many other churches, you'll see that they're used all through the week, not just on Sundays and not just for mutual on Wednesdays. Our buildings are an asset that should be used to serve the community, not just members of the church. And also, our chapels should be a safe place on Sunday. And this actually dovetails somewhat with Blair's presentation. I think we need to turn our chapels, our actual chapels, into safe places for gay people, safe places for all sorts of people, including people like me who don't believe. Why can't we go to church without judgment and be part of that community? I'll tell you a quick story. We recently moved into a new neighborhood in our Salt Lake, in the Salt Lake area, and we reached out to the bishop to let him know that we weren't believers, we would not be attending on Sunday, but we did want to be part of the community. We wanted to be part of the service projects that the ward undertook, and we actually wanted to maybe even come to the ice cream social because we like ice cream. That's the last we heard from the bishop. I don't know that that's typical, but we love the LDS community. We don't want to worship with them, but we want to be part of their community. And our chapels ought to be a place for of safety, not just for people who are actively believing Orthodox members, but for all people of all kinds. If they served coffee, I actually might even go to church. The other thing is that I just want to say that I love the church in some ways. We just got back from a family reunion with all my family are very active Orthodox members of the church, except my wife and me. And we love them. We love our neighbors. We love our friends. We wish that we could feel that they felt safer around us and vice versa. And I think that that is something that the church could work on. Church ought to be a place of safety, not a place of judgment. Finally, I think that if the church were to engage in some of these service, to use its assets, its financial and physical and missionary assets for service, that in and of itself would be the most effective missionary tool I can conceive of. People will come to us, people will come to the church. If they see the missionaries out doing good, that will result, I would submit, to many more baptisms than knocking on doors. Thanks.
Well, I appreciate my fellow panelists, and we were... Is this basically not on? Should I switch? Okay. So I definitely want to echo a lot of those issues. We tried to figure out what are the things we really want to focus on and try not to overlap, but a freaking mend everything you just said. There's also there's also the other thing too. Okay, so people call us Mormon fundamentalists in Christchurch because we have polygamy and a bunch of other things, and I did of course leave the mainstream LDS church for a different church. So the first impulse when someone says, well, what would you do if you were in charge of church? It's like, well, I'd do what I did. Let's make all these changes with all of these different programs the way that I think it should be run. But I think I felt at first that that's more or less lazy thinking. But some of those could have been fun, like we talked about whether or not the temples could be open to multiple denominations of the LDS movement. That could be really interesting, such as... having all the different forms of the ordinances available, and then you could pick which night you want to go to. Do you want to go to live session and Nauvoo version night, or do you want to go on the super shortened current LDS night, or maybe the drive-through version that's probably coming in the future? We could possibly...
Do it by proxy?
Or do it by proxy. I can do it for Blair. It might be fun to have more ecumenism, right? Mutual recognition between LDS movement sects, or have options for creating united orders within within different stakes. Maybe we could move to more of a franchise model. Tithing on net was a big popular one when I started thinking about this. Lots of people have been talking about tithing shouldn't be on the gross, it should be on your net increase. One fun proposition was dropping members from the rolls if they don't attend for a year, so that we stop counting... tens of millions, apparently, of members that are claimed that have never shown up in an LDS meeting house for a decade, and yet we're going to claim them until they're 121 years old, apparently. So who knows what the membership numbers for the church actually are. But I'm a lawyer, and I thought, if I was looking at this very seriously, what could I do that would really help the church? There are three legal issues that I think are causing massive liabilities for the LDS Church. And if they want to remain flexible and they want to be able to control the decisions of their own organization, there are three things I think they need to do immediately. So this is my advice for the lawyers. If you're listening to this and you work at Curtin McConkie, please pass this along. The Curtin McConkie, which is the law firm owned by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which is a subsidiary of the Corporation of the Presiding Bishopric, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Corporation of the President. Yes, those people. Okay. I think that the Church needs to immediately cease performing legal marriages. Now, regardless of what side you fall on as to whether or not the LDS Church should be performing gay temple marriages, for example, the church won't have a choice on the matter unless they stop performing legal marriages.
essentially, by performing legal marriages, the officers of the church, these sealers and what, or even bishops, are making themselves agents of state policy by law. This means that the state can dictate how and when and where a sealing ceremony could occur in the future. Now, right now, there isn't a direct conflict. However, if the church wants to retain control of the performance of sealings or any policy on marriage or doctrine about marriage, it has to stop being a state actor. So, you know, this is pertinent right now because LGBT status, it will soon be added to the Civil Rights Act as a protected status. Now, this is my general political prediction. I don't think that that's going to happen overnight. But there is a lot of agitation for that, and the opposition to adding LGBTQ status as a legally protected status is really waning fast. It seems very likely within the next decade or two that will be taken up by Congress, and it will happen. When that happens, if the church doesn't stop performing legal marriages before that happens, they will lose their tax-exempt status or be forced to immediately perform gay temple marriages. And the reason I can say that with such confidence is because there is already precedent for this, very specific precedent for this. There's a specific case law already established firmly that any institution, including any religious institution, that has policies that violate the Civil Rights Act is not entitled to any special tax treatment or tax-exempt status. There was a case, Bob Jones University versus United States. The final decision was in 1983, but interestingly and tellingly, the whole case basically started in 1978, just after Jimmy Carter visited the Mormon Church, and just before Official Declaration II. The Supreme Court ruled in that case that a religious institution that discriminated on the basis of any protected status had violated a fundamental national public policy, and that the government may justify any limitation on religious liberties by showing it is necessary to accomplish an overriding governmental interest. Prohibiting discrimination is such a governmental interest. Hence, the court found that not all burdens on religion are unconstitutional. Unless they want to lose the choice, essentially, as to whether or not to perform these marriages, they need to stop performing them before that occurs, or they'll be compelled to choose either to pay taxes on all of their capital gains, on apparently more than $100 billion of capital gains liability, essentially on the gains on that amount, as well as all of the donations that are made, or they will perform gay temple marriages at that point. I just believe that's going to have to be done. Now, I recognize that there are some reasons the church might be reluctant to make this change. However, one of the biggest hurdles to making a change like this has recently been eliminated. The one-year waiting period is no longer required. So the church used to have this thing where if you wanted to be legally married and you wanted to be sealed, that those two things had to be linked. First of all, you need a license to be sealed, but then you have to get married either in the temple or if you get a civil marriage, you have to wait a year before you can be sealed. Well, that's in the U.S. And it was, so yes, it was also not a worldwide policy, right? Many countries already did not allow the church to perform legal marriages anyway. So making this policy change would also help with that fully standardizing the temple practices throughout the world, which is another reason why I haven't understood why they haven't done it yet. But there are some drawbacks. Some people are – I expect the church is concerned that this could create increased demand on the church to accept alternative family structures, as Blair is proposing. Maybe they're concerned that if sealing is purely a doctrinal thing, if it's purely a religious sacrament, that there will be plenty of people saying, well, why can't I, as a religious sacrament, have a platonic sealing? You know, why can't I have polygamy? Why can't I have any of these other structures? By linking it with the law, as they did basically since 1890, I mean, if you read the manifesto even, it's all about the law. For a long time, the LDS Church has said that the legal policy is our policy. And I suppose that's worked for them for a while. But unless they want the church doctrinal policy to be dictated by the government, they're going to have to change it before the government does something that they don't want. And I suppose that this change could lead to a disassociation in the minds of members between marriage and sealing as two fundamentally different things. Now, I think that that's great because I do believe these are two fundamentally different things. But it might be a doctrinal outcome the church is seeking to avoid right now. Such a separation of the concept of sealing for marriage could revive older ideas such as the law of adoption, which is a sealing of priesthood holders that the church has not performed in a long time. It could also bring about things like, you know, the queer polygamy model. But I believe that the benefits far outweigh the risks, even just as a lawyer giving legal advice to the church. If the church wants to maintain control over its own doctrine, they pretty much have no choice. I think it's overwhelmingly in their interest to stop performing legal acts as agents of any host government. And that way they kept their options open. Okay, so my second thing. The church really needs to implement a two-deep leadership model, it's usually called. If any of you are familiar with Project LDS Children or Sam Young, the one-on-one interviews of minors that take place are absolutely unprecedented in almost any other organization of any kind that serves youth or children. I actually brought a few copies of the Boy Scouts of America Two Deep Leadership. It's just a couple of pages long. It's a simple policy. Implementing something like that would be seamless. It would be so easy for the church to do. There's already such a precedent in Mormonism for an idea of two witnesses, or two or three witnesses, for any act. By protecting children, by creating a clear, open, and publicly available policy that anyone who is not a parent of the child is not to be alone one-on-one with that child behind closed doors, you would prevent so much of the abuse that has occurred, and it is such a simple and straightforward thing that I can't believe they haven't done it yet. And of course, that would end all the one-on-one interviews, but that doesn't mean that they couldn't have an interview structure if they want one. Now, it's also worth pointing out, this is for the church's protection, at least as much as for the children's protection. The church not only could prevent abuse in that way, but it also makes it absolutely clear that the church isn't responsible for bad actors who have violated their own policy in order to perpetuate that abuse. Right now, the church has a bunch of the current policy with one-on-one interviews and whatnot essentially makes the church directly liable for the things that happen under those settings, which are the church policy that those settings should occur. One of the most interesting things the Truth and Transparency Foundation released, in my opinion, was when I read through a little spreadsheet, kind of a memo that Curtin McConkie had out. Well, it was supposed to be their own secret working thing for the cases they were working on right then about sexual abuse that was going on in the church. It was more than a dozen cases, apparently, they were working on right then. And those cases had reached all the way to the church's council so that the entire church had this liability and problem. And it basically all comes down to all of those things could be easily prevented by simply having a two-deep leadership model where you have to have at least two adults with a child so that no one's completely alone with someone else's child. And this leads me to my third. My third is that I believe the church needs to localize its assets. There's so much central control and ownership that they're also creating those deep pockets that become extremely attractive to anybody suing the church. If they've got $100 billion, they can certainly pay my settlement. It becomes automatically the legal strategy for any organization that wants to sue the LDS Church. Now, this is actually probably my most controversial proposition. What I'm saying is basically the land ownership, as well as the income generation from tithing and whatnot, would essentially be handled on a stake level. Stakes could send money to other stakes that have less, and the church could facilitate transfers between entities, but essentially you'd have individual entities, each stake, owning their own chapels and keeping track of their own finances and being accountable to the members of those stakes for how they handle their own assets. That would weaken centralized church power over local affairs dramatically. For example, if we're going to open up the chapel as a shelter, the local people in Fiji, I bet they're really all for that. It's only the fact that we have a centralized policy that prevents that. But I think that basically what this comes down to is it's a matter of trust. Whose church is it? Does the church belong to its membership? Or is Salt Lake entitled to be a dictator over their local affairs? But overall, I think it's worth it because it would relieve the church of massive legal liabilities in the sense that they're no longer the deep pockets. Why should the tithing payers of Panama be responsible for helping to pay the legal expenses of defending a church when a bishop, an active serving bishop, as was recently on the news, is found to be running a child sex trafficking ring? Do we really want that kind of liability to be aggregated, essentially, so that all of our assets are in danger because of that? And so that's, again, that's also kind of a matter of trust. If the church could localize those assets, localize that leadership, it is true that, say, if an entire stake decides that they're going to become a breakoff group, they'd get to keep their buildings instead of having those buildings torn down by a central church that didn't want to allow that. But how likely is that anyway? I guess, in my mind, it would remove the legal liabilities for the church as a larger organization. If a bishop commits abuse, for example, it would be that bishop who's responsible for it, or the local congregation might have their assets in jeopardy, but it wouldn't jeopardize the rest of the church. And so I think that would basically be worth it. So those are three legal things that I honestly, I'm surprised they haven't done some of them, because there must be some of the lawyers up there who have pointed some of this stuff out.
I'm just going to do my questions from here, if that's cool with y'all. Okay. So, great job. Fascinating points. Blair kindly reminded me that she also wanted to ask some of the other panelists questions. So, after I push back on each one, they're also going to get the opportunity to ask questions and whatnot. So, Blair, I'm going to start with your points. First, let's talk about the ordination of women. This was obviously in the news quite a bit. However long ago it was? How long ago was it? 5-6 years ago? Yeah. What is the doctrinal and scriptural backing that you have for this argument?
So, I mean, I'm going to totally rely on Ordained Women for this one because they've done all my homework for me. If you haven't read the Ordained Women, I think it's 6 discussions, they literally lay out all the doctrinal precedents for the idea of making, building up the kingdom with priests and priestesses. And we have the language in our temple of being priests and priestesses. And we have all this record keeping and ideas about Joseph Smith having this vision of priests and priestesses. So I'm going to totally cheat and say, read Ordained Women, 6 discussions, because the doctrinal precedence is there.
Okay. Now, how would this change how do you see this changing the church's view and teachings around Heavenly Mother, if at all?
Yeah, so that's pretty tricky too. So the idea that the priesthood, so there's a little bit different between priesthood power and then like ordination, right? Ordination is kind of the political access to the priesthood, as opposed to the priesthood being the power and authority to act in the name of God. So far as I'm concerned, anyone acting in the name of God and doing godly things is using priesthood power to do those godly things. Ordination is just the next step. So it would be setting up the precedence of saying, look, priesthood power is already something innately within each person. So with Heavenly Mother in that regard, well, if there's any controversial nature of the status of her godhood or her godness, like, it would be settled by the idea of women being ordained too and acting in the name of the priesthood. And so with that too, though, I know there's discussion about, do you have a female priesthood and a male priesthood, and do you have it gender segregated? My answer to that is no. I think that's a really bad idea. You don't have a female priesthood and a male priesthood because the complexities of gender are already so spectrum, there's such a spectrum to deal with anyway, that the idea like, sorry, intersex people, you don't get a priesthood. I just think that's not okay. And it also raises ideas of like this idea of, it's separate but equal. And when in history did separate but equal work out for us? Not so good. So there's one priesthood, the power and authority to act in the name of God, and everybody gets it. And Heavenly Mother has it too, and everybody gets to be happy.
Now, what would you say to somebody that, I mean, I think personally, inevitably, Heavenly Mother is going to become a part of the central discussion if we start talking about the ordination of women. What would you say to somebody that says that we need to, that, you know, the common saying in the church that we don't bring up Heavenly Mother out of respect to her? What would you say to them?
I would say neglect is not respect. just because we talk about Heavenly Mother or Heavenly Father, is he now no longer sacred? We talk about all sorts of sacred things. And of course, I'm not advocating for, like, you know, doing anything disrespectful, but the idea of not talking about something at all because it's sacred sounds like a sense of pedestalization to try and oppress and hurt other people. I don't like that.
Okay, thank you.
He's like, okay, cool.
on your next point of gender integration, what would you say that a common thing that we often hear is that women are naturally more nurturing, mm-hmm. and that's why they need to be stay-at-home moms and be in the Relief Society in the primary. First off, let me ask a clarifying question. With your gender integration, could men then be primary presidents and Relief Society presidents?
Yeah, and we're doing the two deep rule. I love that. Like, bam, that one's happening, folks. So yeah, it would be the case. The argument is, you know, women are natural nurturers, so they need to be in charge of these things. And I'm like, great, if it's so natural, we don't need a policy around it. It'll just happen naturally. We can break down the policy and let's see what nature does for us. Let's see what people are actually inclined to do and where their talents and skills and sets and all those things take them. Because I really feel like that's the more natural thing to do. So you may find that more women are working with children, or you may find that there are, you know, certain types of men who are really interested in, you know, working with the primary or whatever. But the point is the idea of someone being like, well, it's just natural. It's like, okay, then why do you have to constantly politicize it and regulate it and try and make it so natural?
Fair point.
I'm a little sassy tonight.
No, this is,
I am.
That's why we invited you.
I know. I'm like, I'm Dunstone.
Well, and what about we hear it constantly in General Conference that gender is eternal, right? What would you say to this idea? Because, I mean, with your principle of gender integration and being very inviting to trans non-binary and whatnot, agender folks, how is that going to change
And the family proclamation as well. Okay. So, because you're all going to go buy my book and read my book on queer Mormon theology. It's actually written there. I wrote a whole chapter about it in chapter 6, so I will consolidate that into a very short argument. And the trite statement that gender is eternal actually isn't even in the proclamation. It says gender is an eternal characteristic of one's identity, blah, blah, blah. But let's just say the trite phrase is true. Gender is eternal. Let's say it's true, okay? That's totally okay with me. You want to know why? Because eternal does not mean static. It doesn't mean it never changes. Just because something is eternal means it exists forever. So we have a precedence for this in Mormon theology. So God wasn't, we were taught in the King Follick sermon, God wasn't always God. God was once a man and then became a God. So if God always existed eternally, or God does exist eternally, well, God changed somewhere along the way and had a lot of changes along the way. So just because something is internal doesn't mean it's static and never changes. It just means it exists forever. So if gender is eternal and exists forever, well, we can have a lot of fun with that. We can have an eternal changing gender. I can experience all sorts of different kind of gender expressions and gender experiences and gender identities. The people who wrote that should have talked to me first.
Yes, they should have.
I know the lawyers, they didn't get it. They didn't. They should have talked to the philosophers.
I mean,
Aristotle really spelled this out for us, you guys.
Okay, two more questions for me, for Blair. Both about your queer polygamy. How do you expect to roll this out and still claim that God's rules, that God doesn't change?
Okay, well, that's the rule I would change. I don't think God does not change. That is my Mormon heresy, because God does change. Again, God was once human and now is God. So did God stop changing? All of a sudden was God? When God became God, God all of a sudden stopped changing. There's no more progression. But wait a minute, we also have the doctrine of eternal progression. And we also increase. We increase in number, multiply, and all these things. And is that not change? Is that so, like, how could we ever pin God into this theological box that says God never changes, is perfect, immobile, or whatever? It just doesn't make any sense in Mormon theology to me. So I would start laying the groundwork with this understanding of eternal progression. And we have all the doctrinal and theological precedents to start to do this kind of idea, that understanding that there's all sorts of changes about to happen. Another solution and a way to look at it too is, hypothetically, if you wanted to keep up the narrative that God never changes, you know, let's pretend God is over here, never changes, and does everything the same all the time, which, again, I don't know how you square that with Mormon theology, but that's fine. So God's over here doing these things. That doesn't say anything about our perceptions of God. Our perceptions of God as a subjective experience looking at God and understanding God, those perceptions change all the time. We ordain black men to the priesthood. We do all sorts of things. Did God change or did we change? Who is changing in this scenario? So the idea that God is never changing, well, I don't agree with that. I think God changes, and I think we change too. And I think we're all changing and growing together. But again, this would have to be a slow rollout, so I don't like blow people's minds and they leave the pews.
How slow?
Like, oh, no, that's a hard question. I'm not answering that question. Don't try to pin me in the box. No, honestly, I would say it would have to be a constant feedback. I mean, I like to joke that it's true, though, that continuing revelation happens through surveys. So the church actually does surveys. The church actually gets feedback from its congregants. It actually looks at the numbers, who's leaving, who's not leaving. We have an entire section of church officials who are dedicated to understanding why people are leaving and why people are staying and what's going on. So I would definitely utilize all those avenues, including surveys, to get where people are at. Because at the end of the day, it's not just, you know, Blair the dictator coming in with her gender revolution. My genuine goal towards all these things is that families can be together forever, and families look really different, and all families get to be together forever. Because at the end of the day, that's kind of what Joseph Smith was teaching, that we are one big family, and we need to come together, and you don't kick people out of heaven just because they're non-binary.
Fantastic. Do either of the other panelists have questions for Blair?
I wasn't thinking of any. I might think of
it's
one.
Okay. It's okay if not.
Better not.
No? Okay. Then I will go on to Mark. Okay. First, my first question as a journalist, I have to ask this. What's your source on the $100 billion?
I can't say.
You can't say?
I can't say.
Well, then it's not worth it.
I'm not intending to have it be published. I'm not a journalist. I can just tell you that I have had friends and clients who manage the church's money.
Okay, so we're taking your word for it.
That's all you got.
All right. I'm extremely skeptical here, but...
if you do the math, the church gets... It's estimated about $8 billion in tithing a year. Mm-hmm. They don't spend it all. My understanding is that they do keep that number pretty carefully. They spend what they get, but during the time that it's held, they put it into investments, and those investments generate income year after year, and that's been going on for years and years and years.
Right.
And so that accumulates. Money makes money, and it's accumulated.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. I definitely think it's entirely possible that they're worth over $100 billion. I was just wondering if you had a specific source, because
they have a whole investment advisory firm in the church office building
right. That
manages this money. They're sophisticated people. They know what they're doing.
Right. What would you say to somebody that says, you advocate for financial transparency and that the book should be opened up. What would you say to somebody that says, it doesn't matter because it's the Lord's money. As soon as I hand it over to the church, it is up to him what happens with it?
I would say, I mean, that's what my family would say. Absolutely, that's what they would say. And I would say, well, the church just bought a mall or in a big development in Philadelphia. Did you know that? And usually the answer is no. I mean, they spent like $100 million on this big development in Philadelphia. Did you know the church is the largest private landholder in the United States? They own hundreds and hundreds of thousands of acres in Florida. Did you know that? They had no idea. You knew.
We lived in Florida, so okay. Yeah, we knew.
People knew, yeah. But not everybody knows. And so then the question is, well, if you don't know that, why don't you know that? Why is a church
buying Florida?
Why is a church buying Philadelphia? Why is a church? I work in the City Creek Mall. That's where my office is. They spent $4 billion on that mall. Why? What does Jesus need a mall for?
So. You concentrated a lot on what the members would get, how financial transparency would benefit the members. How would it benefit the church, if at all? Because a lot of people would say that opening up the books would just give more ammunition to critics to criticize what they're spending their money on.
Yeah, I don't tend to look at things from the church's perspective very much, but I would say that...
But if you're a prophet, you have to.
Yeah, I mean, look, I work in the world of finance, and in finance, the name of the game is disclosure. Everybody, every big company, if you buy a stock in Microsoft, you have a right to access their portfolio or their prospectus, and the prospectus will tell you, their quarterly reports, their annual reports are going to tell you exactly how much money they made, how much everybody has paid. That, to me, is fair. That's right. That's what companies and corporations should do, and I think churches should do it, too. And we, as I think most people admit, the church acts a lot like a big corporation, sometimes more than a church. And so big corporations, in my mind, ought to account for how they spend people's money. And if you're going to hold yourself out as a church, then the stuff you do with your money ought to be churchy. And that's the part that kind of bugs me. It seems like if you have even $10 billion, I don't care, whatever the number is, why aren't you using that to benefit humanity? Why aren't you using that to help people and serve others? I mean, the largest homeless shelter, the largest place where people get food in Utah is not run by the Mormon Church. They contribute to it, but it's not run by the Mormon Church. Why is that? That's nuts to me. We have all this money. Why aren't we using it to serve people as opposed to buy real estate assets? That to me sounds like a corporation more than a church. Go ahead.
This actually leads me to push back on that a little bit. Well, no, not necessarily on you, but I'm curious. At what point does this become a major political question? If we're talking about an organization that can control a substantial portion of worldwide financial markets, and as the largest private landowner in the world, essentially second only to the federal government in the amount of land holdings that they can control, at what point does this become a situation where we're going to have to would you support, for example, laws stating that they have to be more transparent because of the impact they might be able to have on, you know, buying the state of Florida, for example? I mean, I think the Florida state government probably has an opinion about how much of their state is going to be controlled by someone other than them.
Yeah, I would. Absolutely, I would. And I think the other question that you didn't raise, which ought to be raised, is to what extent are they controlling state and federal politics, and whether that ought to be a threat to their tax-exempt status. I mean, those are big questions that I'm not an expert in those areas, but I do feel like Great Britain and Canada both require all charitable financial institutions to provide disclosures of this kind of information. The United States ought to as well. This is what, if we're going to give people this advantage tax status of being nonprofit, of being a church, they ought to be held to a standard of disclosure so that we know that they're actually acting like a church. And that really begs the question, is the Mormon church act more like a church or more like a corporation? And I don't know if the answer is that clear.
Maybe next year we should do president for a day and propose the laws you would pass. To achieve your goals here. Okay, let's move on to your service missions. I think the first question that comes to mind when I hear that you want to emphasize service missions is, do you think that the number of baptisms would go down significantly? And if so, would that be a problem for the church?
You know, baptisms are a revenue source for the church. And so...
But if you're going to go spend that money, you need the money.
I don't know if you... We could do a, we could run an analysis of how long it would take to spend $100 billion, and it would take a long, long. I think actually the church could fund itself in perpetuity with that kind of money. It's an unbelievably big number. So that said, the church, I believe leaders do worry about this question of there's a big drain, the cost of financing and the buildings all throughout the world, the cost of maintaining all those properties, the cost of janitorial. All that kind of stuff is very expensive, and I'm sure that they would tell you, you know, this is we're spending money like you wouldn't believe. But honestly, going back to your question, I tried to get to that a little bit, Ethan, because I feel like there's a lot of missionaries out there who are baptizing just for the sake of baptisms, and I think there's people that are joining the church for maybe not always the right reason. Maybe they see it as a rich American church that's going to help them with charity, whatever it would be. There's ulterior motives. I think that if missionaries, and I'm not talking about just starting service missions, those already exist. I'm saying proselytizing is out the door, no more. We're not doing that. But I honestly believe that if people were to see missionaries in the hospitals, in the villages, digging wells, helping people with sanitary things, building hospitals, building schools, that the baptisms would come. I think people would gravitate to the church based on what they are doing, and you don't have to knock on people's doors and drive them nuts. You can actually demonstrate what Christ would do if you profess to be a Christ-like institution. I think you act that way, and people will come to you. And if they don't, well, then maybe they're not doing something right. I just think that's the way it works. But anyway, that's my idea.
So if you're using the example of Jesus did both. He served and he proselytized. Is there any room in your model to be able to function for both? Or are you saying it's got to be an absolute switch to service missions?
No, I think if people come to them, I just think there's no more knocking on doors. You're not proselytizing. Okay. I think if people come to them, they can educate them about the church, sure. And they're going to baptize people, sure. Mm-hmm. But the other thing Jesus did is he also swept out the money changers from the temple. Mm-hmm. And we have a lot of money changers in our temples and all throughout our church. And that needs to end. And so that's the thing that I see. I think that people ought to live the way they profess to believe, and that the consequences will be that people will gravitate to them. That's my idea. I hope.
And then one more question for you, Mark. You talked a lot about you opening up the chapels and then also allowing people who aren't necessarily active to participate in the outings and church activities and whatnot. Why should you be able to benefit from church get-togethers and church outings when you're not going to be attending or paying your tithing?
Yeah, this is something my wife and I talked about quite a bit, and she's here, and we moved into this new ward, and we said, how do we not be freeloaders? So I want to tell a story. There's a friend of mine, Rob McMaster, who some people know, he posted on Facebook the other day a story about a Jewish friend that he spoke with, and his Jewish friend had gone to the rabbi and said, Rabbi, I can't go to church anymore because I don't believe. And the rabbi said, oh, it's not about belief, it's about belonging. You'll always be a Jew. And to me, that's the right attitude. It's not about do you believe, do you do these things, do you pass the temple recommend tests? But it's rather, this is my tribe. I'm a fifth or sixth generation Mormon here in Salt Lake City. These are my people. I ought to be able to be part of that. The other thing that I would say that is that we have, the first thing we said to the bishop is, we want to belong to this ward, and we want to be involved in all the service projects. So we're not going to contribute tithing, but we are going to be, if people are sick, my wife wants to bring them food. And if people are need their yards worked on, we're there. And just put us on the list, put us on the invite list, and we'll be there. And so we tried to overcome that. I think, you know, I kind of hinted at this, but there's a part of me that misses going to church. It's a small part, but it's a part that I enjoy the community of it. And I feel like if the church were a place that was maybe a little less judgy, and a little more open,
then I would maybe go back at some level, of involvement. I hate to say that out loud because someone's going to tell my parents, but yeah, I'm going to get a knock on the door. But I do feel like that we have something. And I live in Salt Lake City. I'm surrounded by members of the Mormon Church. I don't want to be ostracized from that community, and that's the challenge. Mormons are threatened by people who don't believe like they do, who don't meet the standards. Not all Mormons, but a lot of them, and that's what's really hard about it. So,
I just kind of want to second that. There's the famous quote from Joseph F. Smith, I believe, when he was coming back from a mission, where a guy threatens him and says, "Are you one of the Mormons?" And he says, "True blue, dyed in the wool." And you know that phrase, like dyed in the wool, thinking about that. The Mormon just doesn't wash out. I mean, ex-Mormon is just kind of a Mormon with an X in front of it. The anti-Mormon is just a kind of Mormon with the anti in front of it. Once you're in, even people who've joined other faiths, non-LDS movement faiths, completely different. I mean, I know Hindus that are ex-Mormons who still are such Mormon Hindus. I mean, it's once it gets in there, there's something to it.
So here's my question. I actually worked for a design firm for a while because I did architectural space planning. But my question for you is, if we open up the doors for of the chapel buildings for things like disaster relief and things like that, these chapels actually aren't designed for that kind of relief. And I'm not saying to the extremity of like Hurricane Katrina and the Superdome, but the aftermath of that, there was serious damage done to the space because it wasn't planned for that kind of space. And I'm not saying we don't open our chapel doors, but how do you mitigate for the risks of inviting 100 homeless people to come stay here, but then toilets don't flush and things don't work and you have bloody tampons on the floor and all sorts of messes going on. And so it's nice on paper, but then not nice for the custodial service. So would it be worth investing in, like, if we're serious about disaster relief, investing in other facilities? Or do we start designing our churches with the capacity to withhold this kind of emergency relief system? Because I'm not saying no. I'm just saying, so how do we clean up the mess afterwards? I'm a mom. How do I clean up the mess afterwards?
I hear you. And I'm not professing. Yeah, that's the thing. That's actually what I was going to say. I mean, you have a lot of money, and you could put emergency generators and fuel tanks in all the chapels, and you could have emergency supplies, medical supplies, cots. I'm not saying that we should turn them into homeless shelters, because I think they're not designed for that. But in the case of an earthquake, in the case of a fire, like what's happened in California, those chapels can be really places that were valuable for the community, and I think they can be outfitted to get there.
Sure.
Yeah.
Come on. Oh, yeah.
You can be recorded.
I had it on here, but they actually do allow for it.
Okay.
They don't want to be the first choice. They're not really designed for that, but they say you can go to the stake president who goes to the area president, and he goes to the attorneys, and if it all comes back, so yada, yada, yada. So I would have empathy for that because I would say, yeah, this could be a lot of problems. But you've got $100 million. Yeah. I mean, if you get sued, you can pay that. You can buy insurance. And they could also, accommodate. But I was happy that at least there is a mechanism for doing that. So
that must be a change. So that was not that way.
And it doesn't always happen.
And I would imagine it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Because how often are they going to go?
Yeah.
You know, it's guidelines for the use of meeting houses in emergency shelters. Following a disaster, the use of a church meeting house as a community emergency shelter is occasionally needed. Permission is granted by the stake president after consulting with a member of the presidency of the 70 and the area presidency. Approval from the priesthood leader should contact yada, 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 and then talk about the insurance and get to the attorneys and yada, yada, yada.
I just say that's a lot of levels of bureaucracy, though.
It is. I mean, here's an emergency. But anyway, I just wanted to know.
Thank you.
And
I will say this, and this actually goes back to one of Blair's comments as well about the proclamation of the family. I think as an attorney, I'm going to say that the church would benefit from less reliance on attorneys. I really think that they really drive a lot of things. In fact, I'm convinced, going to your comment, Ben, about the whether they perform ceilings, I think that the attorneys are driving many of the anti-LGBT policies because there's a fear that someone's going to be forced to perform same-sex marriages in the temples, and they're, I mean, oh no. That's seen as some sort of really bad thing. I don't think it's a bad thing at all, but I think the attorneys are saying that these changes that you're talking about are coming down the pipe.
Well, sure, and I'm just wondering why their attorneys aren't imaginative enough to just say, how about just not don't do marriages?
Yeah.
Or
how about
religious sacraments? Go ahead.
Why don't we just marry whoever wants to get married if you're going to do that? I mean, if you want to get sealed and you're LGBT, but that goes way back. I mean, it's this anti-gay bias that the church has, and it is driven a lot by attorneys. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. All right, we're going to move on to Ben, and then we will open it up to audience questions. Hopefully we'll have at least a few minutes for that. So, Ben, on your Too Deep leadership proposal, what would you say if a youth doesn't feel comfortable confessing in front of the bishop and the first counselor and the young men's president or whoever else it is?
Okay, so I guess the thing is, first of all, Too Deep leadership does not say which leaders those are. Too Deep leadership is just about whether or not you have some backup. The other thing I would say is we probably do need to relook at the way we're doing confessional. There's a big, I mean, this goes more into the doctrinal questions that I was trying to avoid because I'm thinking that'll be tainted by, you know, my own personal bias instead of what I think is the legal necessity. Yours was totally that way. That's fine. But I think the biggest problem that we've had really is the over-sexualizing of our interview processes. When you say he's uncomfortable confessing in front of two people, because maybe that's one more person than one person, and that's hard enough, maybe this makes it harder, my biggest question would be, what is this person confessing, and why would that be so much harder? Maybe we need to address the shame culture. I don't think that's a Too Deep leadership question, right? It's not about whether or not you have some kind of backup or second witness. That's about whether or not we're shaming people to the point where they're ashamed of things they are totally beyond their control, or whether why are they so shamed that they don't want to confess in the first place is the bigger question. Yeah.
Something like sexual assault, though, or you're being abused by a leader, how does the Too Deep policy work with that then? Because, like, if let's say I was sexually assaulted by a... Let's say I was sexually assaulted by a priesthood leader. How does the Too Deep leader rule help? Maybe I don't even want to confess to a man, or not even confess, but like, you know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. So do you get a pick?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's kind of the thing. There's a whole lot of different leaders. We're not necessarily saying the bishop and the bishop's attorney are the only two people you ever get to talk to or something like that, right? It means that there's accountability for everybody. Let's say you're being abused by a bishop. That's a big problem right now in the LDS Church because you're supposed to go to only one person, and that apparently is the abuser in some of these situations. You obviously can't go to the abuser to report the abuser. A Too Deep leadership, again, you know, there's different permutations about how we could do this, but I would say it's best to leave it open. It'd be better to say you can go to any member of the bishopric, stake president, young men's or young women's presidencies, relief society. They can all sign your recommend. They can all report on each other. They are all accountable to each other.
But that gives women the authority to do that then, because Relief Society president can't sign your recommend.
Yeah. Right, right. Okay, well.
I like that. No, let's do it.
I'm for that.
What about getting rid of interviews altogether? Why do kids need to be asked any explicit questions about their sexuality?
I'm not in favor of asking children sexual questions of any kind at all. However, I do think that there is a long religious history of there being some kind of guided mentorship or introspective process or confession type of thing. Many, many faiths have that in some form or another. So, I mean, I'm not against the idea of having some kind of spiritual accountability or mentorship that you have with some leader. But when it comes to anybody under the age of 18, I'm assuming if there's going to be a sexual problem that a child is having, what you want is a safe place for them to report it, not anybody grilling anybody about that. when they're underage. Now, adults, gender issues, they're complicated, right? Sexual issues, they're complicated. Adults, between adults, it's a totally different question as to whether or not we want some advice or some help about those issues. But when it's a child, they're not supposed to be engaging in sexual behavior. The best way to prevent sexual behavior against children is not to groom them in a private one-on-one room while you try to describe to them all the sexual things that they could do. Right? You just leave that out. If it comes up because it's a problem, then that's why you have the 2D leadership, so there are multiple leaders that they can go to report the problem. And otherwise, don't ask them.
Awesome. My next question is about your decentralizing property to the stake level. What does that make the law of consecration look like?
Actually, I think that that makes it so much better, so much more possible, right? Because each stake, and this is, these are some of the suggestions that more of my Mormon fundy friends and or my perspective really wanted, was thinking, yeah, that's exactly what we need to do, is that each, if each stake actually has, well, forgive the pun, if every community has a stake in their own finances and has a stake in the outcomes for their own community, then consecration means something, because you're building up your own community, you're working together toward a common goal. And so when, how does this affect the law of consecration? Well, I think that it's the only way to make consecration possible, essentially. Especially if you're going to have some kind of united effort, some kind of united order that was going to happen within a stake. The only way to do that, essentially, is to bring that down to that local level, because local communities know their own needs, and then they can provide their own needs. If you're shipping away all of your assets and abdicating all of your authority as well as your own financial decisions to an outside group in Salt Lake City who may or may not know anything about your local needs, then, yeah, you're never going to be able to actually have individuals building their own community.
Wouldn't that lead to unequal situations where people, churches on the east side are going to have fancier churches than on the west side or something like that?
Yeah, because if you take a look at, like, if I'm in Highland, my church is going to look a lot different than the church in, you know, South Provo. Mm-hmm. And if you take that into account for, like, you know, Ghana, Africa, like...
Right. Well, having an individual local community project doesn't mean that they couldn't coordinate. I mean, I would think of it more like a franchise kind of model. Essentially, the main church headquarters would coordinate efforts, they, as well as the fact that if there was enough transparency, you'd know where there were sufficient resources that could be consecrated to other projects for poorer communities. All of that's very possible. In fact, if you go back to Pioneer, Utah, I've studied a lot about the early United Order experiments. They were constantly sending resources to one another. This is very coordinatable. But they were also deeply invested in their own unique project in each of those United Orders. But they were, there's a great deal of commerce that goes on between individual orders. So I don't think that that would necessarily be a problem. But it does bring up one other thing that I would sort of do if I could, and that is, why do we have such tiny units? Why do we have so many church buildings for such small numbers of people all meeting at different times? That this is a massive waste of resources, as far as I can tell. Why would you have more than one stake in the Salt Lake Valley? I mean, we're all a community, right? Now, I recognize that that's a lot of people and all, but that's why we have a structure for this.
Shrinking by the day.
And it's shrinking by the day anyway. So I think that we've vastly overdivided our congregations. If you're in one of these cities in the American West where there are more than 10,000 members of the church in your area, well, yeah, I understand that that basically makes it the Mormon Church a mega church in that area, but I still don't see any reason for us not to know each other or to divide ourselves into such strict smaller congregations. So why not do a bigger unit? If you have 100 people in your ward, I mean, there's plenty of them where it's like 12, you know, families that are really doing everything. So,
in the original comments, you mentioned, Ben, that you're a recent adherent to the Christ Church.
Yeah, I'm a 70 in Christ Church.
Okay, so